Syria has gone through massive changes over the last few months. The brutal dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad has fallen. What is the new leadership like? What will it do next? On today's show, we talk to an expert from the Syrian Network of Human Rights to find out. Welcome back to Trumpet World. Earlier in the week, I sat down with Yumin Halak from the Syrian Network for Human Rights, an independent organization that monitors human rights and human rights abuses within Syria. She gave us a fascinating look at events on the ground and provided some important context that can often get missed on a show like ours, where we're trying to kind of simplify and summarize the news or an important story in just a very short period of time. Here's how she introduced herself and her organization.
Yeah, for me, I am a researcher at the Syrian Network for Human Rights. Our work right now is focusing on two things: transitional justice, basically, trying to affect right now the policy makers. To start this road of the transitional justice. In general, the Syrian Network for Human Rights was established in 2011 from the beginning of the Syrian Revolution, and since then we have been committed to documenting human rights violations in Syria, whether committed by the Syrian regime or the previous Syrian regime or other parties to the conflict as well. In addition to our daily documentation efforts, we regularly publish in-depth analytical reports, which is something I personally do. These reports on the violations, and we provide usually verified data and the clear attribution of responsibility. And our publication also cover broader themes as patterns of enforced disappearance, torture, attacks on civilians, and the use of prohibited weapons. Also, we produce thematic and periodic reports, as well as urgent updates that inform international bodies, media, and policymakers, as I said. And recently, we've been focusing on transitional justice in specific, and also on political transition. Through this work, we aim to support accountability mechanisms in the first place, advocate for victims' rights, and contribute to justice and peace building effort. So this is basically what the Syrian Network for Human Rights do.
She had some important observations during that interview on the fragile situation right now. But to get us caught up on that situation, I asked her to summarize some of Syria's recent history, going back to the start of Syria's civil war in 2011.
Okay, so during these 14 years, as you know, there were a conflict between many factions, but it all started with the Syrian Revolution. In the beginning, there was peaceful demonstrations against the regime, because it's an authoritarian one. But the Syrian regime started bombing cities, start arresting people, arbitrary arrest, killing people just because they are demonstrating against it. And then the conflict becomes, armed conflict. Some armed groups emerged, and then later on, some jihadist armed groups emerged, local ones, people who believe in global jihad. We had jihadists from different countries. They established what is previously called Jabhat al-Nusra, and then Daesh also has, or ISIS, sorry, controlled some areas in Syria, and the conflict between all of these factions started. Before the liberation, Syria was divided to four controlling areas. You have the Syrian Democratic Forces, which are like a Kurdish-led forces. They control the north east. You have HTS or Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, leading by Ahmed Shara, who is the current president. They controlled the northwest, and the Syrian regime also controlled most of Syria, I think two-thirds. And we have also what is called National Army, which was like Turkish backed. And you know, many countries interfere in the Syrian war. You have Russia and Iran supported the Syrian regime, and they were like the main reason for its survival for the last 14 years. And you know, also the Turkish government has a side, the United States, some European countries as well. So it was like a very complex conflict. But after all, the civilian paid the price, and the Syrian regime was the main responsible of most of the atrocities that happened during the last 14 years. This regime was responsible for the death or the killing of nearly 500,000 Syrians, the detention and torture of hundreds of thousands of civilians, the displacement of around 16 million people as refugees and as internal displaced. It also destroyed about 60% of the infrastructure, bankrupted the state, looted its resources, and turned Syria recently into a hub of the Captagon drug trade. So, the Syrian regime was the one who opened the door to foreign and regional interventions in Syria, many of which also contributed to civilian suffering. So the Syrian regime was the main responsible for what happened in Syria. And we are in the Syrian Network for Human Rights documented across these 14 years all the violations committed by the Syrian regime, the killing of civilians, arbitrary arrest, enforced disappear, torture, displacement, all of these violations. We also documented the violations committed by the other party to the conflict, but we can't compare both sides. All the party to the conflict committed crimes and violations, including HTS, including the Syrian Democratic Forces, including ISIS, of course, and including like different armed factions. But the main responsible was the Syrian regime. That's why I'm telling you that the fall of this regime was really a turning point in the history of the country. And personally, I believe that no authority replacing Assad could ever commit the level of destruction he did.
That brings us to the new government. Yumen is cautiously optimistic that we'll see some improvement for Syria, but she's also very realistic about the challenges the country faces.
Of course, regarding, for example, to the new government or to the new leadership, as you know, it's controversial due to its jihadist background and the fact that it also was a party to the conflict with its own record of violations over the years. So there are certainly negative sides, but there are also positives that can't be ignored. Of course, as you know, violations are still happening under the new government. It's also clear that the authorities are struggling to control their own forces, which is something like, very complex and very bad. There is also a degree of one-sided decision making, especially when it comes to that constitutional declaration and forming the new parliament. So we can notice some authoritarian behavior in this new government, but on the other hand, there is now some space for freedom. People can criticize the government and put pressure on it. Something like we couldn't do for the past 50 years. There is also a notable freedom or a notable press freedom. Now both Arab and international media can access conflict areas and report freely. Now I'm talking to you about the new government, and I'm not afraid if I went back to my country. I'm not afraid like of being arrested because I'm just criticizing the government or criticizing the way they govern, criticizing the violations that took place in the coastal area or in Ceuta. Also, efforts are being made to improve the economic and living conditions in the country, and this is a very very important thing. Of course, there is a lot of debate about how the new leadership came to power, but I believe we are in a sensitive transitional phase. We have a real opportunity to rebuild the country. So as civil society, it's our responsibility to keep pushing the government, holding it accountable, and help steer it in the right direction. So yes, we have challenges right now. And the situation in many levels is complex in the social levels, in the military level, in the international also and regional level. So there are many challenges, but I think it's our responsibility today as Syrians to try to overcome all of that, support each other, held the government accountable for what they do.
Of course, some of what the new Syrian government has done or been involved in are some pretty major atrocities and massacres. That's what's been on the news most recently. Here's what Yuman told me about those.
You know, after a half century of Assad's regime embedding sectarianism and nearly 14 years of a conflict fueled also by sectarian division, we know that the road ahead remains long, especially let's say on the social level, because you know Syrian society right now is deeply divided and polarized as well. And this fragmentation is worsened by the spread of hate speech, incitement, and misinformation, especially after the violence in Ceuta and in the coastal area. On the other side, on the military, let's say, front, the situation also is complex. First, although the armed factions are supposed to have unified under a single national army, I can confidently say that this unity is superficial. Many violations have been committed by members of security and defense forces, with some individuals and groups continuing to act like factional militia. Let's say the ranks today are filled with untrained and undisciplined fighters. Some of them are too young and just recently joined these forces. Some of them still behave like mercenaries, just as they did within their former factions, and some of them are simply, you know, untrained. They didn't recognize, or they haven't recognized yet, that they are serving in a formal institution, and they must have a kind of disciplined, and they have to act in a certain way when dealing with civilians, especially. So we can't say that the army or even the security apparatus are strong and centralized institution yet. Additionally, on the other hand, you know, weapons today remain widely spread across the country. And largely outside state control. The recent violence in the coastal region began when former loyalists, fighters, attack local security forces. In Sueda, the violence become or began when some armed Bedouin tribals attack armed Druze factions, and then the situation escalated, and the formal or the governmental forces interfere, and you know, a cycle of violence started in the area. So today, weapons are in the hands of many actors. You have remnants and loyalists of the previous regime. You have Bedouin tribal armed groups. You have Druze armed factions as well. And also we have the Syrian Democratic Forces, which are Kurdish-led and control much of the northeast of Syria. With so many rival groups armed, unfortunately, the cycles of violence are likely to continue. As for also the general living conditions, as you know, Syria is a war-torn country. Its infrastructure is devastated, the economy collapsed, poverty is widespread, and all of these factors only, you know, deepen the crisis. The current government is trying to change this reality by attracting investments and pushing for the lifting of sanctions. But we also say, we can say that the road to recovery remains long and challenging.
So you mentioned the factionalism, division, that the Assad regime did a lot to try and cultivate that. I'm curious, you read a lot, say, on Syria's history, tracing a lot of these divisions back to Sykes-Picot and the British and the French dividing up the Middle East and kind of creating these countries that were lines on the map that don't reflect reality on the ground. How much of Syria's division is a result of just people with different backgrounds and religions kind of just being forced together in one country? And how much of that is something that is a direct result of the Assads and kind of divide and rule and that kind of situation?
You know, that's true. This this problem is like, you know, goes back to decades ago. And of course, the colonizers have a hand on all of this. But, you know, Assad family has been ruling for 50 years you know, till now, and they you know, did this division as a way of controlling it, to control people. Syria is very diverse. They have like a different different cultural, regional, sectarian backgrounds, or even like different ethnic backgrounds. In Syria, we have Arab and Kurdish, which are like two different ethnic groups. We have Muslim and Christian. Among Muslims, we have many sects. There are Alawites, Sunni, Druze, Shia. So these divisions, and the thing is that each sect, let's say, are, you know, the people of this sects are living in a certain area by their own. For example, in the coastal region, most of the people are Alawites. There are like Muslim Sunnis as well, but the Alawite population is concentrated in the coastal area. In Suweida, you have Druze mostly. Most of the Druze are in Suweida. Kurdish people basically are in the northeast. So this geographical division made people like tend, you know, to keep like together apart from the other sects or the other ethnic and religions groups. And also during the last 14 years there was like many sectarian massacres. For example, Alawi did like many sectarians against Sunni, and the conflict in general was like had this sectarian dimension. This created grievousness among Sunni people, and now they are in the they took authority, let's say, or people think like Sunni now takes authority before Assad was Alawite. And so all these divisions make things complex, and it's very hard right now to overcome all of these factors. For example, what happened recently in Suweida was like has also a sectarian dimension. Sunni considered the Druze like they didn't see them like as Syrian, but as like a different different people. And also on the other hand, Druze perceive Sunni in the same way almost. So I can say that we are almost far away from you know, acknowledging what the citizenship means with all of these sects and ethnic groups in Syria, mostly like fighting through the last 14 years, and the division between them was like deeply embedding during the Assad era. So the situation right now is complex, and it demands like some conscience about the situation, because as I said, there are like armed groups, Sunni armed groups, Druze armed groups, Kurdish armed groups, and as long as these weapons are widely spread between like different these different rival factors, factions, the violence cycle will, you know, will continue. So what we need right now is kind of stability. The weapons shouldn't like be widespread like this, so we can like start a rational conversation between like different groups in Syria. But as long as we have violence, as long as the economy is collapsed, the infrastructure is devastated, these kind, you know, of these kind of things might not like happen easily. So I think we're still like far away, but it's possible to rebuild what has been destructed. But you're talking about decades of division, so it's really hard to overcome that.
Divisions between the countries around Syria also play a major role in the conflict. Here's what Human had to say about that.
Also, the political situation remains complex. There is a notable level, let's say, of Arab acceptance of the new reality. Countries like Saudi Arabia have already begun proposing, you know, investments in Syria, and seem to be cooperating relatively relatively well with the new government. There is also a certain degree of recognition from European and American actors. There are, like, you know, talks about lifting sanctions recently, and some sanctions were, like, partially lifted already, along with efforts like to support and give the current experience a chance to succeed. Iran, of course, like, doesn't wish for a strong and united Syria, but also they are weak right now. They lost their best ally, which is Hezbollah in Lebanon or in Lebanon. So they can't, you know, play a vital role in Syria right now, even though I think they may try in the future. But I believe that the biggest threat right now is Israel. You know, it appears like to seek the division of Syria and its long-term weakening under the pretext of protecting their borders. Also, through repeated airstrikes, Israel has destroyed much of Syria's defensive military capabilities. It's reportedly arming Druze faction, encouraging, you know, them, like, to separate from the central government, while also pushing for a completely demilitarized zone in the south, all of which pose, you know, serious threats to the country's stability. Also, on international level, the situation remains deeply complicated because you have, like, competing global interests are at play in Syria. Russia, Iran, the United States, Turkey, all have like involved in different ways in Syria previously and now, while the Syrian state itself, like, remains very, very fragile and weak. So I believe that these countries, you know, each of them have different interests in Syria. And they are trying to play a role in the region, but the biggest threat ever is Israel. As I said,
some have said that the current government is a Turkish puppet. They're basically controlled by Turkey and Erdogan. Is that true, or are they kind of more independent from Turkey?
I think, like, it's a very, very it's a very simple, you know, perspective. People who say, like, things like that try, like, just to simplify the situation, where it's, like, far away more complex than that, because Turkey is not the only regional force that have interest in Syria. There are, like, as I said, like, many rival countries which has, like, different interests. I believe that no one, like, right now, no single country, let's say, affecting you know, the decisions in Syria. There are, like, many factors. United States have a role. Turkey, of course, have a role, especially that the Turkish government previously backed the national army, which is a part of the new governmental army right now. Arab countries also play a role. They support the new government. They have some interest there. Also, you have, like, many other regional forces. So, you know, for the current government, they have, like, to make balances with all these regional and international forces. So we can't say that they are a puppet for Turkey, because Turkey is not the only player in the or actor in the region. And also, I feel like there is some misinformation about how the liberation happened. Of course, Turkey has backed, as I said, the armed groups which contribute to the liberation. But I believe that the favor of liberation is not only, goes to Turkey. There are also several factors. You know, previously, Hezbollah from Lebanon was like a very, the main supporter for Assad regime, and their militias were spread all around the country. But after October 7th and after what happened in South Lebanon and after the death of Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, the Hezbollah militias' role were not like that strong in Syria anymore, and most of the militias get back to Lebanon to support to support Hezbollah there. Also, Russia played a very vital role to support al-Assad, but recently, Russia is like very busy in the Ukrainian war, so it doesn't have the capability, or let's say even it wasn't like interested in Assad regime as it was before. Also, the regime collapsed from the inside, because, as I said, with this large spread destruction, with the economy collapsed in Syria, where the Kiptakon trade thrives in the regime controlled areas, all of these factors weakened the regime, and simply the Syrian army started like to ask why we should defend this regime. I believe the average of the fighters' salary was about $10, which is ridiculous. So why would these people put their lives in danger to defend the Syrian regime? So you have all of these factors together, and all of them contributed in this liberation. Even with the Turkish backing, the Turkish government backing the factions which contributed to the liberation, but from my opinion, I don't think that Turkey wanted or pushed for the fall of Assad regime. I believe that the plan was to reach Aleppo and to take Aleppo, and that's it. But when the armed factions noticed that weakness in the Syrian regime defenses, they continue, till they liberated Damascus and the regime fell. So I think when we say they aren't just Turkish puppet, or Turkey was the force who liberated Syria, I think that this is a ridiculous simplifying of the situation. It's far away more complicated than this.
So based on what you've said, is this a fair summary of the situation? There is a risk that the new regime and Sharaa, they could be one faction that has kind of conquered Syria and rule for the interests of that faction. However, the biggest risk and the biggest threat going forward is the fact that Syria is divided. There's a lot of weapons, and basically things could just fall apart into sectarian fighting kind of all over again.
Yeah, but the situation is really it's not simple. On one hand, As I mentioned before, that we are like not seeing some kind of one-sided decision in the government. Syrian people like wasn't pleased with the recent constitutional declaration, or the way that the parliament has been formed. But however, you know, there are like many factors that we should take into consideration. Because let's say that this regime fell right now, what will happen? Even though that the current government try like to unify all the armed groups together under, you know, under one or single national army, we still see that some of them like still act as militias. So imagine that they don't have this center, you know, power anymore. So they are already fragile. We don't know what kind of alliances will appear. Maybe Russia or Iran will support Alawites in the coastal region. So a new civil war will erupt. So from just a rational perspective, I believe that even though we are like we are not 100% agreed with the new government, but because we are in transitional period, we have no choice but working with each other. So the balance that should be made is to work with the government and at the same time hold it accountable and put the pressure on it to, you know, to at least to gradually change the situation. But we can't go like extreme to say we are fully support this government and whatever they do. And we can't go to another extreme and say, no, we don't want Ahmed Shedder. We want like a new government. Let's make elections right now. And with this very, very fragile situation. So it's very complex. We can't say there is one solution, either this or that, white or black, because yeah, you know, the reality on the ground is very, very different from the discussions on social media, what people are saying. Some people really support the government in a very extreme way. They supported whatever they did, even after the violations in Ceuta and the coastal region. The government itself admit these violations, but some people don't want to admit that, and they support whatever the government do. And on the other side, some people like just want to make this to make or to see this government like fails. But the thing is, if it fails, we don't have a choice. If it fails, the whole country will, you know, will go toward a new civil war again. So you see, we need to do this balance. Not only us, even the governments have their own balances that they should do. As I said, there are like many regional and international countries who have interest in Syria, who have rival interests in Syria. So the government should make kind of balance between all of them, because it's weak. It doesn't have any other choice. And also on the local level, they have many balances to do, because you know their grassroots are like, we can say, far right. And this far right doesn't, you know, doesn't accept what the government do, and they think that the government like becomes too liberal, which is not true. But to them, they you know, perceive the new government as like a liberal government, which doesn't go along with their own perspective to how the government should be. And on the other side, you have people who perceive the government that it's Islamist one, jihadist background, Sunni, etc. So the government also should make a balance between these people and these people, because they can't lose one of them. So it's a very complicated. We can't simplify that, saying the government is bad and we should topple it, or we can say that no, they are doing well. We will extremely support them. We need them. We need this new government. And I believe they are trying to do some, you know, some good things in many levels. I believe that we should give them a chance, but at the same time, we have like to be very careful with that. Keep putting pressure on whatever they do, and held them accountable wherever they do violations. So it's a very complex situation. We can't simplify it with like either this or all that. It's very complicated.
And where's the best place to get more information if people want to read those reports that you've talked about, you know, website and social media and things?
Yes. In our website, you can see or you can find all of this information. You can take a look our analytical reports, and we also update regularly our data. We have data to document the killing of civilians, the attacks on civilians, but the arbitrary arrest of civilians, and also any, you know, enforced displacement. So on our website, you can find all of these data and information.
And that's snhr.org, is that correct?
SNHR, yes.
Great. And anything else that you've not mentioned that you think, you know, the rest of the world, individuals interested in this, need to know about Syria and what's happening there?
I think basically, as I said, like I just like want from other people like to read more about Syria, to not simplify things because it's not simple, to understand that there are like many factors right now that affecting the situation, so we can't see it from like from a certain angles, and we should also take that the context into consideration. So basically, you know, the situation is very complex, and people like just should try to understand it from like different angles, let's say. And in the end, all we need right now, or all we want right now, is a sense of safety and stability, so we can like begin to rebuild what Assad has destroyed over the past decades. And to do so, we need to read the situation very well, apart from our apart from our emotions. Let's say.
So I found that a very helpful look at Syria from somebody very familiar with what is going on the ground. And here on this show, we cover world news from a biblical perspective. There are laws and principles in the Bible that help us analyze world events. But then also, Jesus Christ himself had a lot to say about world events of the future. Herbert W. Armstrong talked about this a lot. Here's an example of what he used to say.
Very few people have ever realized that Jesus Christ came as a newscaster. He was the most famous who ever lived, and he brought news. It was not old news that had happened minutes or hours or days before he reported it. It was news of the future. It was a forecast. It was a prophecy for the future. His news is yet to happen even in our time, although he gave it over 19 and a half centuries ago.
And so here we follow in Christ's example and we look at what the Bible says about the future. That's enabled us to make some very specific forecasts. Here's what Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry said shortly after the start of the Syrian Civil War in 2012.
Well, I'll tell you, this is all tied into Bible prophecy. And really, what is happening in Egypt and Libya. And yet we've said for years that Syria is going to break, probably, the strong indication of that in the scriptures in Psalm 83, to be specific, that Syria would pull away from the Iranian orbit and go another direction. And that's what's happening. It appears very, very much right now on the world scene. We prophesied that many years ago, well over 20 years ago.
That's exactly what has ended up happening. And here's what he said a couple of years later.
Here are the Hagarenes then being, in all likelihood, Syria. And even they are going to get allied before this is over with Europe, of all things. I mean, there's strong indication of that right here. And certainly, Gebel, Lebanon, will be allied with Europe. That's what's happening there right now. This is the prophecy that's being fulfilled right before your eyes.
And this is, I think, something we're still seeing happening right now. And we have a whole video that I did on this prophecy in Psalm 83 that Mr. Flurry talked about that forms the foundation of why we expect this shift to happen, why we forecasted this shift. In that whole program, Mr. Flurry was saying, well, watch for Syria to be broken out of the Iran orbit and instead be part of this alliance with Turkey, with Saudi Arabia, and with Germany and some others. That has happened. That they've broken out from Iran, and they're very heavily influenced by exactly these countries. And it's Turkey and it's Saudi Arabia that are making these links with the government and holding business meetings and these kind of things. And when you hear about what we talked about today, though, I think it's clear Europe is going to have to watch Syria more closely and maybe get involved more closely. It's still fragile. There's still a possibility that Iran could try and muscle back in. But I think it's also clear that, again, Bible prophecy describes the situation that is on the ground and how it's going to develop. The Bible forecasts what would happen. It continues to be your best guide in a complicated and fragile situation. It's a book that has a lot to say about the modern world, about your life. I mean, as Mr. Armstrong said in that clip, people, even churches in this world, don't talk about the role that Jesus Christ played as a newscaster. And the Bible is Jesus Christ in print, the Word of God in print. And you dig into the news, and ultimately you end up seeing more of what the Bible talked about happening. It's a book that has a lot to say, a lot of relevance about your life, and it contains the only sure hope for Syria and for many other countries. That is at the core of the message we want to get out here on Trumpet World. If you want to know more about that, we have our free book, The King of the South, that has a lot more to say about Syria and about all of the Middle East, what the Bible says will happen there, and then where all of these world events are leading, the important context to understanding all of these events, how it fits into what Jesus Christ said. And he has a long prophecy in Matthew 24, Matthew 25, where his disciples asked him, what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of his age? And if we're Christ's disciples today, well, we need to be asking some of those same questions, thinking about those same things. And Christ didn't respond by saying, well, don't talk about that. Instead, he gave them a long and detailed answer, and he referenced, well, you need to understand this that was spoken of by Daniel the prophet. And he pointed back to some of these same Old Testament prophecies that form the foundation for our understanding of what is happening in the Middle East. So that book will help you understand that important component of even Jesus Christ's message that churches in this world don't talk about. You need to understand Jesus Christ's role as a newscaster. And so much of that news revolves around the Middle East and around Israel and around Jerusalem. And our book, The King of the South, makes that very clear. All of our material you can get on our website for free at thetrumpet.com. We'll send you that book. You can read it online for free. We'll ship you a free print copy. You just need to give us your name and address and we'll get that sent out to you. We don't do anything else with that data other than just send you a free book. I also mentioned I do have that previous show where we spent the whole show delving deep into that prophecy. So if you'd like to know more about Syria's role in Bible prophecy and see a whole show on that, We can link to that, and you can go and look that up as well. Well, thank you once again for Euman Halleck and the Syrian Network of Human Rights for joining us on today's show. I think that was just a really informative interview. Thank you to George Haddad for engineering and production. If you have any questions, any comments, you can get in touch with us, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We'll be back for our regular Week in Review show on Friday. And until then, keep watching your world.